thank you for inviting me, all of you at UXR, and for tolerating my sometimes jaundiced view of the academic world. It's not really that jaundiced. It's one of the points of genesis of this presentation is something that came out of the work with the Metropolitan Philadelphia Indicators Partnership and out of NNIP issues generally. In the academic environment, we're very, very conservatively oriented toward data in terms of it should be completely documented, you should have complete confidence in its use, and it should not be conducted by, it should not be collected and distributed by people who have a vested interest in what the data have to say, which in a very real sense means that a lot of public sector data as data comes with a lot of questions. Unfortunately, most of the things that interest me in terms of the city, the things that are beyond the normal housing market, vacancy, tax delinquency, abandonment, things like this really operate on the margins of what the normal housing market is, and we don't spend a lot of time looking at it because we don't have really good data that talks about it. Most municipalities, most counties, most localities do not have adequate, trustworthy data, and it's been an interesting journey along the way. It's been very much bolstered by my association with my a former student and my colleagues at the Reinvestment Fund, particularly the Policy Solutions Group, that does an awful lot of work on research questions, and they really focus on the data that is problematic. Some of you may be aware of something that they usually turn out called the MVA. I know that that has a meaning behind that acronym. It's essentially a real estate market, a market value analysis of housing in cities. You'll see an example of this as it comes along. They do a very good job of setting up a basic framework and then adjusting the framework depending on the data that are available. And they've got some fairly interesting ways to make sure that the data can actually be trusted. Some of it involves something that, you know, a lot of academics have, I'm sorry, this is an academic audience. A lot of my colleagues at Temple have a lot of trouble doing something called ground truthing, where you take an estimate that comes out of the data and then you go out on the street and see if it makes sense. Because they're very concerned about what happens next. As I say, I operate with this model of a housing market that has thresholds. Basically, you know, you can't play in the housing market unless you've got a certain income. You can't afford certain kinds of housing. It segregates and systematically cuts the housing market in different ways. And for people who are very poor, people who suffer economic dislocation, people who suffer prejudice, they don't get to play in the same housing market. And in its worst case, when you get down at the bottom end of a housing unit's useful life, if we think of it that as a concept, you realize that what you've got is a structure in place, but it's probably going to take a lot of money to turn it into something that could be marketed as housing. A lot of the drivers on this are very basic. We know about shifting demographics. Philadelphia, just as one example that may sound familiar, Philadelphia lost roughly 25% of its population size between 1950 and 1990. And it's kind of been sort of floating along at about the 1.5 million level ever since then. It has gone through tremendous income shifts, driven by the transition from a union industrial economy to a post-industrial service, creative class, part-time, part-year employment base. And what we've been forced to recognize in the last few years are some of the housing market drivers. We're not clear about tax delinquency, which we'll come to. We are fairly clear that foreclosure has the foreclosure, and before that, the subprime mortgage situation has driven selective markets from being homeownership markets to being much more rental markets has dramatically affected the value of homes, so that we can look at the degree to which homes are underwater, the degree to which people are engaged in, if not panic selling, if not jingle mail, where they send the keys back into the lender. Well, you've got a real question about whether these housing markets will persist in the same way in which they have. And that, in turn, we've just started looking at what the implications are for communities that are no longer getting tax revenues at the same level that they've expected, because the housing values have begun to decline, the vacant housings are beginning to pile up tax delinquencies. There's a whole set of add-on effects. We're not going to get to all of this today, don't worry. This is part of a much larger and much more complicated discussion. And I'm trying to adhere to Guy Kawasaki's basic rules of 10 slides. I violated that. We've got 16 slides. We won't quite have 30-point type and all that. But, and 20 minutes is probably a little optimistic about how long I'm going to bend your ears. But we'll try and keep it down to reasonable size, because most of what I find of value in this discussion is getting the discussions of people's experiences in their communities here. Even in Philadelphia, we find out that we do a presentation, and then it's a lot of the communities around Philadelphia say, but it's not like that out here. Good. Two basic spatial expressions we're going to explore. A regional one for the Philadelphia metropolitan area, at least the way it was defined in the year 2000. And this the city level, which is driven by data that's much more focused, that's been collected and processed by the reinvestment, my colleagues and I at the Reinvestment Fund. The regional context has to do with foreclosure risk. The city context has to do with some of what we're seeing in the last several years. We're not trying to link this explicitly to foreclosures, but we do know that there is something that is drastically shifting the nature of the housing market or the housing picture in the city. And the areas that are of particular interest to me involve these three. And Ira Goldstein, my colleague at the Reinvestment Fund, has really been focusing recently on the impacts of foreclosure, which we'll get to. I'm going to start with foreclosure, just because that's the area where I've been doing most of my own individual work, but also because it links up to an issue we've come across in the last month or so. We know a lot about what a good, solid, substantive analysis of housing data, housing market data, can show. Most of you are familiar in one way or another, I'm sure, with HUD's NSP program, which was built on data that was provided by foreclosureresponse.org. It's a housing research center. And it focuses on the risk of foreclosure. And it's particularly good at regional, statewide, metropolitan levels at ranking where communities are. And it really provides, in broad brush, the comparative risk that different communities face of having foreclosure. They also do a separate analysis that deals with market strength, which we'll get to. Market strength and foreclosure do not overlap perfectly, and it's of interest to see where they don't. And they also, it's very obvious that some of this links into patterns in the regional economy. That's the first part of what we're going to talk about. In Philadelphia, there's actually, thanks to what the Reinvestment Fund actually does, some real information about actual foreclosures. So what we've got waiting for me when I get back is to run their analysis of actual foreclosures versus the predicted foreclosures to see how good the NSP data are. But we're not quite there. They do a nice program with a diversion court that's been set up in Philadelphia to handle foreclosure appeals, and they've been that's been a program that's been very effective in allowing foreclosure processes to be interrupted and for people to retain ownership of their homes. And there are a variety of different things that are going on with that, including an interesting kind of demographic link and a heightened risk of falling prey to foreclosure scams that seem to be experienced differentially in the minority communities of Philadelphia. Okay. MPIP, for a lot of years, while there was a subprime mortgage market, tracked that market. Red is bad. All right? I will simply use the pointer here. Philadelphia is this area right in here, dominated by that large red patch. This is Camden. These are the inner ring suburbs that were part of industrial towns in Philadelphia. And this is Coatesville, another manufacturing center in the region. These are classic old-style, late 19th century, largely row homes, small, narrow. They're not exactly what the market will bear. So it's not surprising to see that, and these are also areas where there's a lot of lower income and minority people. Yes?
Could you just show on the map, because I don't think...
No,
my...
See what you're doing. Not working.
The pointer doesn't translate over to the map. Okay, here's... I know that I had a... That's what I'm looking, what happened to it. It disappeared. It walked. Now we can do this. All right, here we go. Philadelphia is this area right in the middle. There's a matter of orientation. The Delaware River runs along here. This is New Jersey. This is Pennsylvania. This is Coatesville. This is Chester and the industrial suburbs on the western and southern fringes of Philadelphia. There are some industrial communities up along here, including Roebling, where the Brooklyn Bridge was built, fabricated, and then brought up to New York. A couple of little funky things, like this is a defunct military base in southern New Jersey that used to have pretty high demand for housing and now doesn't. What we found was that in the subprime, well, we kept raising a question in our minds. We understood a lot of this, but what we couldn't understand was the relatively heightened level of subprime loans in New Jersey suburbs. They are the most recently developed suburbs. They have some of the newest housing. Did not make a lot of sense. And as you'll see, this will continue to be of interest. When we translate this into the foreclosure risk scores, the highest risk areas are in Philadelphia, some of the same communities here. The area around Coatesville broadened, but most of New Jersey. Now, I made the mistake at a conference of speaking my mind and saying what we referred to in our regional analysis in informal conversation. We understood this perfectly, because anybody in Philadelphia knows that South Jersey sucks. Yeah, well, somebody from New Jersey, from another university, Rutgers, I believe, said, "You can't say that!" I said, "Well, okay." And she said, "If you'd stop saying that, I could give you data." Well, that hasn't happened. I stopped saying it, so... Ah, my... What in recent years, foreclosure response has done is to create an index of market strength, which really has to do with the level of the volume of sales and the value retained as a result of real estate sales. And this is where we've got something else, which is, I will tell you quite frankly, this is simply a puzzle. There is no way in the world that you should have high foreclosure risk in a strong or moderately strong housing market. Yet, in key areas of New Jersey and in suburban Bucks County, in the communities around Coatesville, we know that there's something else that's going on there. That's an itch that we keep trying to scratch, and we can't get good information. The one thing we do know about New Jersey is that at a county level, we know that the recovery from the recession has lagged most of the region. Their unemployment rates remain higher. We know that if people bought into that housing market using adjustable rate mortgages, which were evidently differentially marketed in southern New Jersey, foreclosure is, subprime lending is in some ways a gift that keeps on giving. Once you've entered that in, that evidently creates a real, particularly with the adjustable rate mortgages, has an effect that lasts beyond the years at hand. But that's for a different conversation than the one I'm trying to get to, which is much more driven by a focus on the city. Focus on the city allows us to really fine-tune some of our data adventures. We can't ground truth across the region because, for instance, each of the 9 counties that we focus on has a different property recording system. Each of them have different rules about how and when to employ actual formal foreclosure actions, and some of them absolutely refuse to let you have public information. Okay? Philadelphia has practiced that tactic in the past, but anyway, there are ways in which not being an academic makes it easier, because the reinvestment fund ends up having some interesting ties to the way in which a former mayor practiced a neighborhood transformation initiative, which got them entree into a lot of the property information, tax information, property value information, sales information, and a long period of time in learning the ins and outs of dealing with a poorly entered, lacking in quality control, property information system emerged. Essentially, it's a series of tests, and you can only you process a data set of 560,000 property units, and eventually you begin to find out where the red flags show up. So if you can get access to that kind of information, be prepared for a long learning curve. This is the MVA, the market value analysis, that's been most recently done in Philadelphia. And I want to point out a couple of basic things. The darker the purple, the more significant and more competitive a housing market is. This is gentrifying around Center City. This is the traditional wealth in Chestnut Hill. This is a newer gentrifying area around Manayunk and Roxborough. This is the far northeast, if you follow that line, anything further than that is something that was built after 1945. That was all farmland prior to that. This is the industrial city. These are the neighborhoods that were linked to industrial development. This is the area around the University of Pennsylvania, which shows its particularly limited development. This is what, in our original descriptions, we talked about some of the first analyses we did of vacancy and abandonment. We talked about 3 different scenarios. Ghettos, Gold Coast, and ghost towns. These are the ghost towns. This is ghettoization. And the Gold Coast, if you had talked to us in the 1980s, we would have pointed to the high vacancy rates in and around Central City. This seemed to be a purposeful letting, to use an agricultural phrase, developers were letting the land stay fallow until the demand and the opportunities emerged. We'll come back to that theme.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
It says transitional.
Yes.
Is that in flux? Should I read that to mean transitional in both directions?
Or yes.
In both directions?
Yes. Okay. The jury's out, and in fact, these yellow coded neighborhoods are the ones that the city looks to as where they might have an effect with limited resources. They are able to focus in and take a careful look at whether or not this is a trending upward or trending downward, and what strategies are involved, what could help.
So they get prioritized.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't want to use the triage term yet. Yes?
Does Kensington fit? Is that blue under Kensington?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's not the same old Kensington and Fishtown.
Yeah, okay.
You've got three of the best restaurants in Philadelphia are on Long Girard Avenue on the edge of... Unbelievable. Massive development in Northern Liberties that's pushed north up into Fishtown and Kensington. Really, it's not the same old Philadelphia, which is, I think, in some ways a very good thing. Now, any other questions about these particular categories? I'm not going to go into great detail about them. The only point I will tell you is that if you see that that blue area up in Germantown, there's an interesting story behind that. It had been transitional until somebody forced TRF to go in and do a little bit of ground truthing about what was going on there. And they found out, in fact, that was based on some bad reading of some of the sales information. And one of my co-authors and co-conspirators in the Indicators Project, Carolyn Adams, happens to live in that neighborhood and happened to be the one to say, what are you talking about? And it was more than just kind of neighborhood pride. It was, you know, there were real problems in terms of handling the data.
Dave, one thing, there's some folks here that were involved when the NBA was done here in Pittsburgh. Does anybody have any ground truthing examples from the Pittsburgh one? Bob, do you know of any? You were involved in that. I know there were a lot of complaints about a lot of
I know there was a process involved where I wrote from TRF, came in with a few other folks, and we go around the city together looking at data and just trying to figure out anything that looks strange. And I think one of the things I think that they learned in a lot of neighborhoods, or some of the neighborhoods, was that the market data just didn't show the market. And
yes. This is one of the things I would caution people about using. And it's not a negative caution. It's just kind of when you start an MVA process, you realize there's a lot of fine-tuning that has to happen. TRF has got it pretty well nailed in terms of Philadelphia, but I will tell you that they are pulling out their hair, and most of them still have enough hair that they can pull it out, over places as diverse as Reading, Pennsylvania, or as Houston, Texas. Each of which presents their own challenges. Even the notion of a spatially defined market is challenged in a place like Houston, where there are no underlying zoning to control the kind of building types that go in. So it's a real challenge. But the key thing here is that one of the best things that I've taken away from this is something that people should take for granted. Whenever you're dealing with housing data and neighborhood data, because of its granularity at times, two things. One, go for the most granular level data that you can. And second, be careful how you assemble that into coherent markets. Be aware of your biases. Always ground truth that. Always get out and, you know, develop a model, then go out and test it. That's the only way that you get around some of these issues. There isn't a data set that's out there that's just waiting for you to sit back in an office somewhere and handle it. This is a hard lesson for some folks to get. Second challenge in terms of data has to do with the notion of vacant residential properties. Now, thinking back to the other map, you notice the concentration in through the old manufacturing neighborhoods. Think of this as the kind of some of the ghost towns that are present. The other thing I want to challenge you to think about is, when is a property vacant? How do you know it's vacant? I love the fact that LNI actually tries to come up with licenses and inspections, sorry for the code word, tries to come up with a count of vacant properties. It's a drive-by. And it works from a pre-existing list of vacant properties. So it's always biased toward has something come off of the vacancy list rather than doing a de novo count of new vacancies. So it's very hard to look at the only thing is that an LNI has access to the demolition permits or the warning uninhabitable permits, so that flags one set of properties. But if you were to take a look at the United States Postal Service data for properties that have been vacant for more than 3 years, you come up with a different set of criteria. And you come up with a whole different, you get both old properties that haven't been inhabited, but you also come up with a set of addresses that are new properties where they got caught in the real estate squeeze. So, the interesting thing I will tell you, the punchline on this is, you look for an independent verifying kind of source. And for us, this will, I think for Philadelphia, it's going to end up being utility companies. In particular, the water department has a very good, robust data set that deals with use of water in a property. So if you have something coded as vacant and you've got no utility use, you can pretty well say that's a long-term vacant / abandoned property. Abandonment, however, involves a certain legal kind of position where you can show no awareness of an owner, no participation, no interaction between the owner and the city. And that's usually around issues of tax delinquency more than anything else, but there's an incentive for people not to reply to the city if they get served with notices of delinquency. There are incentives in that tax delinquency system for property owners to disappear, to create a corporate shell, and to disappear somewhere into the woodwork. Very interesting, not a problem in terms of really trying to focus your efforts. So we can get so far in this discussion, and then we really have to say maybe abandonment's the wrong way to think of it. It's enough of a problem if something's long-term vacant and you can't track anybody down to deal with it. Yes?
Well, given that analogy, you're depending on all these systems being at their best and working in cohesion and doing something well together.
No.
Where you don't have that in a lot of categories,
yes.
In a lot of instances, you actually have to get, not through the drive-by, but you actually have to get on the ground,
yes.
And walk and look at that and see for in itself, because even in a drive-by, it doesn't really get you to what you need to find out.
Absolutely, and I will tell you that there are folks that long before Google had its approach to having photographs, which would likely go away somewhere. There are lots of ways that people have talked about using infrared to detect activity. There's lots of those are technological solutions rather than what we found is that individual neighborhood. Can you imagine drones flying through neighborhoods? Anyway, I'm sorry. I get really punch drunk with some of this stuff myself. I can tell you that the best analyses that we've seen end up being the kind of labor-intensive, community-driven, when communities have an interest, when somebody with skin in the game starts really pushing this, that's when you get the good, solid information. You can't do it at the level of, we were talking about some of the analysis of data on cities occurs at about a 30,000-foot level. At best, some of this data gets down to about the 10,000-foot level. The stuff on the ground, that's people who have got skin in the game. I would love to be a fly on the wall in some of the real estate development operations in Philadelphia that have done a very good job of finding out what's going on. They're, if I could kind of have a eyes and ears in, no reason you would know this person's name, Bart Blatstein, who created a massive entertainment and residential complex on the edge of Northern Liberties. Took an old brewery and just leveled it and created a massive a piazza, lots of little restaurants and shops in the area, lots of condos and apartments in the area, and it transformed that community. He had some of the best information about what was going on in all directions. And, you know, I would love to be in on that without having to sign away privacy rights, but anyway. And on the tax delinquencies, the last 2 weeks in Philadelphia have been interesting. Plan Philly, which is a kind of adjunct of the University of Pennsylvania, and has done some very interesting work in terms of trying to figure out alternative uses of land in Philadelphia, including building Center City out to the river, just published a long series. Patrick Kirch, the author of the series and who works for Plan Philly, had done a tremendous amount of work in terms of identifying tax delinquent properties in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, there are something on the order, I said 550,000 residential properties. There are somewhere around 650,000 to 700,000 total properties in Philadelphia, including commercial, manufacturing, public facilities, and so forth. Approximately 110,000 properties are in tax delinquency. As Everett Dirksen said, sooner or later you're talking about real money. One of the things that got people most upset about this, and I'm not as upset about the kind of social justice of people not paying their taxes and getting away with it. I am concerned about it in terms of real questions about neighborhood development and whether neighborhoods can attract attention. But one of the things that it was possible to do with the data file that Kirkstra was using was to separate out the number of years that are delinquent. Now, this is Strawberry Mansion. It is an interesting neighborhood, and if I think that we've got it here, Philadelphia back in the 1960s had one of the first major urban race riots right around Cecil B. Moore and Ridge Avenue was the center of that. That neighborhood significantly declined in terms of overall population. You could not get a mortgage anywhere in the area, and it's gradually been refilling, but I want you to take a look at the number of properties on some of these blocks which are over 5 years tax delinquent. I don't worry about anything up to about 5 years. You know, given what's happened in Philadelphia in terms of its economy, in terms of people's income basis, I'm really not worried about that. And it turns out that the amount of money per property is really, forgive the expression, it's chump change. I mean, it's not very significant in terms of the overall fiscal impact on the city, nor is it not something that could be worked out on household deals. But this is a much more intractable kind of problem. And it turns out that in the due diligence that goes along with these data, we stumbled across yet another issue, which I bring to your attention with the hope that you never have to go through this. The thing that really, there are two things, two reactions to this that bear mention. First of all, there was a spatial econometric analysis that was done, this is the 30,000 foot level of data, on the city that said, basically, if you had a property within 500 feet of a tax delinquent property, it would affect your value by $X $100.56. Now, I understand, you know, that this is just an example, but nobody should put that into a report. Because you take a look at a neighborhood like this and you go, are you telling me that I should worry about, given all of the demographic shifts and all of the population loss and all of the housing condition problems, are you really suggesting that because somebody's tax delinquent, that's affecting the negative, you know, the value of the property? That's not what's, that's, it was a poorly phrased way of putting it.
Wait, yes. When they said value, did they mean sales?
Sales value.
Sale, okay.
Not appraisals. The second reaction was, this began bothering people when they started taking a look at the number, the length of time, and they said, "What else is going on here?" I know that somebody's on to say. Somebody says, "What else is going on?" It means they know something. And here are the things. You're going to get a high end. In terms of tax delinquencies, you see a jump in the distribution that goes from about 12 years to about 20. Now, 12 years ago, there was a tax lien sale that offloaded most of the tax delinquent properties and took them out of the database. So we can't come to a reasonable conclusion because nobody tracked whatever happened with the tax liens and the properties that they were attached to. So what we got are a whole bunch of unresolved old tax delinquent cases that are being lumped in with the more recent information. Second thing that's become very problematic. Philadelphia has become known as a tangled title town. There's a group of a nonprofit group of lawyers doing a lot of research into what the frequency and extent of that are. I'm not confident enough in the way that they chose, but they use a very common sense cut line. They said, take a look at anybody who owned a property who had a particular ownership name in 1941, and if that's still the owner's name on the record right now, you've probably got a tangled title. Okay, that's number one. Second thing is, there is a pretty active small entrepreneurial activity in Philadelphia called deed sales. I can get you a deed to any property in Philadelphia that's been not active on the real estate market. If you give me $500, I can make the deal. I'll have the deed to you in about a week. Does that mean that it actually got registered anywhere? No. And it brings up another, I think, relatively normal process that we don't have a good way of tracking. When, in order to satisfy a debt, somebody sells you a house, but they don't sell you the house in the kind of title of, you know, you say, pay me $500, you can have the house. That doesn't go through a sales transaction. It's never registered in the deed office. And you have a significant number of tax bills that are being sent out and are not delivered. But they're being counted as delinquent, even though you have no idea of whether it ever reached the person who might be willing to pay taxes. Yes?
Well, I'm assuming that this is similar in Philadelphia as it is here. When you're talking about real estate tax delinquency, are you talking about tax delinquency to the city? Because here we have city, you know, we have city tax and school tax as well, and county tax.
Mm-hmm. No. Philadelphia is a city and a county.
Right. So, but what about the school?
And the school district receives its money through the tax revenues collected by the city.
By the city, so you have
the. We've got it.
Having just one.
Yeah, we've got that wonderful. Yeah, I know. I don't envy any other. Yeah, when we try to do any of this work over in New Jersey, they've got very active counties that have a very complex way of distributing the revenues and of counting what the taxes are for. That's really a problem, but I understand the pain.
So Dave, you're saying there's an informal market for housing sales that's not being recorded in any of the usual chains that would go through a public sector agency.
Yeah, and in my next life, I'll go to work for ProPublica, and we'll get a, you know, a nice, a good public interest journalism outfit.
Has anyone done survey work in a, you know, like in a constrained area to kind of figure out what the those figures look like, or
no?
Because nobody's going to, you know, people, I guess they're not going to answer a survey and say, "Yeah, I bought this with cash."
until this work was done, I will tell you that until this work was done, you couldn't interest people in trying to ferret out what the real impact of foreclosures were, because nobody had ever, you know, this is new. All right, so that's one of the things we expect to happen. And again, it will be driven by community-based organizations that want to know what's going on specifically in their neighborhood. Okay, we are moving way too slowly through this, but this is shifting over to foreclosures. I make an obvious point, foreclosures only happen where there's a real market. Banks don't choose to follow through on foreclosures if they don't think they can sell the property. So we're going to get a lot of lower percentage. It doesn't mean the housing market's great. It doesn't mean that there aren't people in debt. It just means there's lower levels of home ownership and less of a likelihood of going to foreclosure. We know a lot about the risk factors, about where foreclosure is going to happen. The lowest levels are in the best housing markets, and these areas that are in particularly Upper North Philadelphia, Lower Northeast, Oak Lane, West Philadelphia, those are generally regarded as the neighborhoods in the greatest economic travail. And they have some of the most intransigent housing market issues. This was all so done as part of a Fair Housing Initiative grant that they did a crosshatch in which the majority African-American neighborhoods mirror some of the high-risk foreclosure. This is the Latino concentration in Philadelphia. So we know that there are differential consequences by community. This is a base map that we're going to be using in the extension. These are the actual foreclosures that actually were completed, sheriff's deeds as of the end of that past year. This is where the sheriff sale took place. And we will be comparing that to the predicted risks and see whether that pans out. Next steps, we're going to probe the delinquency expose, real questions about the quality of the data. A suggestion that nobody would have paid attention to delinquency had Philadelphia not been shifting to an actual value initiative in terms of real estate assessment. It's created a lot of problems in communities that have been previously privileged by having under-assessed properties. They are very pissed off that they're suddenly being taxed at the level that's close to what they're really worth. And the vacancy issue, we're moving forward to talk about linking up water department, doing a better job of separating out vacant land from vacant structures, and of disentangling the industrial delinquency and vacancy issues that are part of this. It's an interesting data question. It's much more interesting in terms of people's lives and people's communities. And my little note to myself that I wrote at the bottom of this slide is, like most of the time I've been doing this kind of community work in Philadelphia, these are the times that try people's souls. All people of goodwill struggling against the entropic tides of market decline, of municipal decline. So that's nice, but honestly, this is just, it's dirty data, it's dirty-ish, dirty problems, it's in a city that's practiced community neglect selectively. it's nothing that people aren't aware of and familiar with in their own cities. I think that what I've found in my time working with TRF, it really helps. It really genuinely helps if you've got people who have a vested interest in resolving this. Their particular motto is leverage at the point of impact. They are looking for places that they can impact, and they make those decisions at a very granular level of information. It's led them into probably the most innovative set of data collection exercises I've seen. So for that, I'm always grateful to go into work there and have fun. Okay.
Good.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
And I'm gonna sit down, and we can have questions.
And when you ask a question, can you identify yourself? Because I think you've heard a lot of people from different pretty interesting areas that will reflect also on the kind of the work that your own organization or your own research or department is doing as well. So let's open up for questions and get started.
Yeah.
Yeah, my name is Kryn Hoyer-Winfield with the Urban Redevelopment Authority. I guess a natural question would be whether there's been some good comparative studies between the Pennsylvania side and the New Jersey side to try and track back to state laws. Or...
Yeah, there are some limited examples of that. And the question of whether there's some comparative work in terms of Pennsylvania side versus New Jersey side, there are a couple of examples that are of interest, and they illustrate something which I could have mentioned earlier, but which I'll mention now. The one major comparison is between Camden and Philadelphia, and actually Camden, Chester, and Philadelphia. All three of these are areas which have high risk of foreclosures. All three of them have real tax questions. All of them have real issues in terms of transfer of property. What seems to be the case is in localities, it's important to understand what the poison is that you're forced to deal with. In Camden, because it's New Jersey, you have access to certain state resources that are far superior to what you can access if you're in Philadelphia trying to access Pennsylvania resources. New Jersey is a much more geographically compact state, and most governors understand, this is not an aspersion about any particular governor, all right, despite my personal feelings about the current incumbent, it's very hard to get the attention of a Harrisburg legislator, period. If you're talking about Philadelphia, and I suspect in western Pennsylvania you see some of the same you've had some of the same experiences. If you're in Trenton's the capital, you're experiencing what Camden's experiencing, and you've got to pay attention to that. When Christine Todd Whitman was the governor, she convinced the Republican Party to hold their convention in Philadelphia, and in order to have access to the hotels in New Jersey, she completely instantly revamped a major gateway into the city of Philadelphia, which created new investment interest in Camden that lasted for a little while. And it also, there's a statewide agency that is really invested in finding new markets and in generating new housing markets across the state. So there's more of a shared initiative in New Jersey than there is in Pennsylvania. In Philadelphia, let me just, before I leave that, the poison that goes along with Camden is, this is a city that at some point, I think it was 5 out of the last 6 mayors went to jail. And the last mayor that went to jail because the material bribe that was taken was a used panel truck worth $11,000. For that, he gave redevelopment rights to the mafia. God, that's cheap. Jesus. And the problem was he couldn't stay. He didn't stay bought. I mean, that's why he got turned in. You know, in Chester, Jeremy Nowak, who used to be the head of the reinvestment fund before he moved on into philanthropic efforts and now into consulting, wrote a nice piece with Ned Hill about civic capacity. What each of these cities have as a particular issue, but Camden and Chester have more than most, is they don't even have the necessary staff to track property transfers. One of the most fundamental aspects of why city governments were set up was to track real estate transfers. They don't have it. Camden has 2 days out of five, there's somebody in the office to enter property transactions, to register deeds. It's the way it is. The redevelopment authority is virtually non-existent. In Chester, it's worse. In Philadelphia, there are issues. They're sort of manageable, but there are issues that we know of, and we just don't know what the depth of them are at this point. One of the major issues, which in casual conversation, which we're now in, rather than having to do a formal presentation, when the early work on market value analyses was taking place as a predecessor to the Neighborhood Transformation Initiative, there was one of the jobs of folks at TRF to go around and talk with people that were working in the different offices dealing with redevelopment. And in Philadelphia, that's not just the redevelopment office. It's about half a dozen different departments that deal with this. And somebody was asked, well, how many of the people here actually work on issues of property disposition and planning and so forth? And the guy that headed the office said, no, the question you should ask me is how many of the people that you see work? And the answer was, in a room of about a dozen people, he said, two people actually work. The rest simply draw a paycheck. Now, that's a jaundiced view of somebody who's really, you know, I understand that attitude, but it doesn't take you very far. Trying to figure out how to make this actually work. Philadelphia has theoretically the capacity. It's trying to get people to actually work on this, and that's actually been a tremendous change. Camden and Chester, no. So the big differences are there. The other thing is there's an information vacuum about most of South Jersey, which we've had a very difficult time trying to penetrate in terms of particularly the institutional economics of banking and mortgage dealings. That's not something that people have been, either the information isn't there or people aren't talking about it. Yes?
Hi, my name is Rebecca McLean. I'm a CPD rep in the Pittsburgh office here. You mentioned NSP dollars earlier, and I'm curious where the city of Philadelphia used their NSP dollars.
And also, Pittsburgh only got, of all the programs, NSP1. That was it.
Great.
Could I ask a question? Could somebody decode all those acronyms?
Yeah.
NSP, Neighborhood Stabilization Program. It was an effort that was put forward to deal with foreclosures, clustered foreclosures particularly. There were three different waves of funding, two that actually resulted in real funding of any significant amount. I cut out the slide on where the Philadelphia NSP dollars were invested because it's damn well depressing, and you can't figure out. It happened where there were identifiable neighborhoods, but there were only three that received real dollars and where real work was done. A lot of the rest of it went into the infrastructure of, you know, planning to do something. Some of it actually went into the diversion court background work. So I'm not trying to say it was all wasted. I'm just saying it was a very different strategy. And in the first look at the map, it's very depressing because you take a look at the size of the problem and you take a look at where the impact is focused. Yeah. Yes?
Do NSP funds correlate somewhat to CDBG eligibility?
There is probably a link to eligibility, but it's like you've got you've got foreclosure risk. If you are then also CDBG eligible, you will tend to have a better chance of getting dollars put into that particular neighborhood. Yes. That's a broad brush statement. I would not want to say that's how it actually works in particular cities, depending on which office is administering the funds. I would not want to go any further than that. Yes?
Chuck Happ of the mayor's office. So with the initiative, as you said, to allow community activists and community groups to really try to get answers to what might help them best and get access to data or whatever information, what would you say are the three or four things from a Philadelphia perspective, which is your source, that really they can't get at, but if you could get it in their hands, they could probably accelerate to achieve their outcomes that would help them? I'm trying to look at this because, you know, we have a lot of people who are willing to do things, but they may not have the information they want, so maybe government and other funding agencies could figure out how to just get out of the way and just let codify or get things regulated so the public, the active public who's interested rather than the general transparency guidelines.
I understand. I understand.
What is missing? What should they get?
What's missing? When I first started thinking about this project, and I think it's still in the title, something about data silos. One of the real inertial problems of city governance that I can see is agencies who are concerned about access to data not because of confidentiality, but because of performance issues and because of fear that people will find out how data has been cobbled together. Now, against that, I can tell you that there are two or three things that happen in Philadelphia that have made this, I think, interesting and more accessible. And they're not all on the city side, but some of them are. One of the best things that ever happened in Philadelphia was when the police department decided to go to a GIS process of identifying where crimes happen as part of a strategic operational decision. It's very similar to CompStat, CrimeStat. That's okay as far as it goes. I can't believe that they hired a planner to develop the GIS material, because he built in the capacity of doing neighborhood profiling along with crime profiling. And he is currently the chief principal in a mapping firm called Azavia. His name is Robert Cheatham. As long as people understand what they're dealing with, he is a businessman and he is very interested in turning out quality work that can be used in a civic environment. And he pushed that button in a lot of different ways around the city. He pushed for opening up data sources and validating data sources while he was working there. Now he's in the private sector, and that's a little different. He just basically looks for clients. He's worked in Columbus. He's worked with our mapping indicator project for the region. Very skilled guy. He, as you might expect, his plate is very full. It's hard to depend on somebody who's got 15 other projects that are all demanding things of him. That's essentially an organizational culture that has started to open up. Philadelphia has, we were talking about this last night over dinner, Philadelphia also has the benefit of having hired in an open data officer to go across departments and start forcing open public data sets. Essentially, it's run out of the mayor's office. It's not run out of the managing directors. It's not run out of any particular agency. But you can force open the kind of data sources where people on the outside, community groups, researchers, they're going to raise issues about the data when they find problems, and that's a challenge that cities have to be willing to take, or municipalities. They've got to be willing to take this on, because people will find that there are problems. These are not professional data processors who put together these systems. These are people who had a particular job to do. And to some extent, some did it better than others. But nobody's had to validate that. Nobody's had to really do the ground truthing that's necessary. I think that Philadelphia has that little advantage. The other thing is, I will point to two different efforts that predate the open data officer in the city of Philadelphia. The reinvestment fund started off as the Delaware Valley Community Reinvestment Fund, and about 12 years ago, they hired Ira Goldstein away from HUD's Fair Housing Enforcement Program. He's a data fiend, among other things. And he really gets the connection between policy and data, and he really gets completely, this is a very unique set of talents. If you find somebody like this, get them involved immediately. He's also very much of a, has a business orientation that understands that some neighborhoods, a city doesn't have the resources to put in to significant long-term programs. Some neighborhoods they can invest in. Some neighborhoods it will take a public-private, independent sector relationship. All of it involves community-based efforts to work in partnership with this. And that's the second example. Philadelphia, luckily, and this is something that came out of a fraud case, it has a very active association of community development corporations that process and share information across those organizations, run workshops on how to use the information, run workshops on how to do neighborhood planning, serves as an information clearinghouse across the city. That's an invaluable partner. I would also say that those are lessons that have been learned by different groups that don't come out of the straight CDC movement, so that you know that women's community revitalization program, they have their own spin. They turn to people who know how to do this work. You know that Congreso de Latinos Unidos, they understand, they bring people on that do the work that they need to do. There is a better premium now in Philadelphia on actually getting decent information and making information-based decisions than there has been in my entire life engaged with the city of Philadelphia. I can't believe the changes that have happened and the degree to which the climate about information sharing and information access has changed. Oh, it's still a struggle, but it's not like you're going to solve it all in 1 year. You just have to begin saying this is something we value, because we can't solve this. No city has the resources necessary to take care of all of its neighborhoods with all the issues that confront them. Every city needs to figure out how to take a first and second and third step to put effective information sharing at the forefront of whatever agenda they're going to develop. That's my basic take on this. And I can actually say, for all the things that I say about Philadelphia, this is something where Philadelphia actually has worked at this. I wouldn't even dream to try and tell you the stories of the first meetings around information sharing, which happened 30 years ago, and in which you couldn't get people who were running COBOL and Fortran-based programs to talk about sharing information because it was beyond their technical skill level. So, we've solved a lot of the technical issues. We've got GIS applications that can get you down a very granular level and figure out sensible ways to build that up. You can create great profiles of communities. And you can use this to start figuring out what strategies would work in which places. What can I say? The best thing about the last 2 years is when I took retirement from Temple, I tried to inform people that this was not me retiring from the work I love to do. And believe me, people who, where I live, they look at me going out, I'm getting ready to take the car down to the airport to fly out here, and a guy says, "I thought you were retired." I said, "Yeah, but I retired from silly meetings and silly memos." And I will not say that applies to anywhere other than Temple, because I'm certain that everybody runs their place better than, and their agency better than what Temple did. But, you know, there you go. Yes.
Actually, I'm going to try and mash three questions together. But my name is Jarrell Brackett, and I am a part of Public Allies, which is an AmeriCorps program.
Oh, good.
And the first question I have is because I was looking at the MVA from 2010 to 2011 back on my phone again.
Yeah.
Tioga, North Central, Juniata, Frankfort, Olney, Oxford Circle, and Mayfair are all predominantly African-American and Hispanic communities. Is it normal for communities in America with African-American and Hispanic populations to be largely distressed or transitional?
It's not abnormal. And what we know about, I want to make sure that I say this in the way that best fits the information that we have. Philadelphia has a significant all-white population living in very distressed neighborhoods. What happens is that as Philadelphia shrank in population size, the housing opportunities that were opened up had been of not the best housing stock, and that those were opportunities that were really different than the worst case housing that minority communities had been living in. There's also a demographic reality in Philadelphia. Another version of this talk is Philadelphia is one of the most segregated cities in the United States, and there's a J curve that comes down through North Philadelphia in the top boundary, Oak Lane, all the way down, and then goes over to West Philadelphia. That took 90 years to create that population pattern, because Philadelphia was basically desegregated up through 1920. White Philadelphia, prior to 1960s, was immediately to the east and northeast of that, and to the northwest, and in South Philadelphia. And as that population has aged, a new emerging immigrant population, although technically not immigrants because most of them were from Puerto Rico, a Latino population has moved in and taken advantage of housing opportunities that have served essentially as a buffer zone between white impoverished, white working class communities that are in very distressed housing situations, and African-American communities that were very significantly ghettoized, and they have fit in between that. That's changing.
Okay.
Tremendously changing. So the lower Northeast, the Mayfair area particularly, that's where you're starting to see a lot more migration of people who had been in the city for a long time, but also new immigrants from the Dominican Republic, and we can get into the Asian population is a very different thing. And by the way, in Philadelphia, we also know where the Cuban immigrants are, not in the city of Philadelphia. They're out in the suburbs. It's a very interesting cluster, but that's a different discussion. You said three.
Yes, the second one was, when looking at foreclosure risk categorizations, why would a neighborhood itself be labeled as being high risk, strong, moderately strong market? Because you had said earlier that that was odd, and there were several portions of that map that were like that. And I just, as I heard you said, I didn't understand how that could happen.
Well, we don't fully understand it either. A strong real estate market, you would think there would not be significant foreclosure risk in those areas. Likewise, in a weak market, you would expect not to find, high foreclosure areas, you wouldn't expect to find strong markets, but you can find that as well. Some of this is, frankly, you know, we can say things about the region, but when you get down to local conditions, the question you ask really focuses on what are the kinds of more, in our eyes, has tried to resolve itself in terms of what are the kinds of mortgages that were being given out in high market areas. For one reason or another, New Jersey specialized in subprime mortgages, and particularly ARMs, ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages. They did. We don't know why. We know that they are now the market leader in terms of government-secured loans, which has come to replace the subprime loan. And we're not sure how that... It's one of the itches we're trying to scratch.
Can I do a follow-up on an element of your question?
Just tell Dave who you are.
My name's Paul Naraki, and I'm relocating to Pittsburgh, so I'm trying to
get
things out here. What constitutes a strong market? Is that like relatively recent tract homes and plenty of it?
No.
Or what?
No, in Philadelphia particularly, a strong market...
Well, you were talking about you were focusing on Jersey.
Okay,
so
or in New Jersey, you would tend to focus on newer construction.
Right.
Development communities that were purposefully priced at a particular level. People went in with a pre-existing notion of what the market was.
Right.
And they were getting that because they were new construction. And people were looking the other way in terms of some of the household income that was going on. We think that's what was going on.
And they were qualifying people in for the...
They were getting people over... Yeah. We think that that's where the difference is.
Sure.
Yeah.
I live near a place called the Inland Empire. 20 years ago, it was nothing but empty, and now it's nothing but roofs.
I know.
For sale signs.
Yeah. Yeah, I had... There's very good work that a guy at the Orange County Register reporter has done on that foreclosure story.
Right.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice work. Very bad situation. Yeah. Last one.
The last question is, in Pittsburgh... Well, I'll bring us all... Philadelphia is the largest metropolitan area in Pennsylvania, but Pittsburgh has two that are right underneath it in terms of economic growth, and one is the downtown area, and the second one is Oakland, where we're sitting. In between is Uptown, and I've never been able to understand this for as long as I've lived here, because I've also lived in Philadelphia when I was going to Westchester and living in the city.
Okay.
But I have never understood why a place in the middle of these two economic areas seems to have so many buildings that are distressed and vacant. Even though we know that most of these buildings are owned by one person itself, I cannot understand why this area is looked as a corridor and not looked at as, hey, we could build houses and we could build businesses here, and you know, people should be renting from here for about $1,000 a month. They can walk into the city. This area has always, like, for at least the last 40 or 50 years, people have largely avoided it.
Mm-hmm.
There's not even a grocery store around here.
Mm-hmm.
I have not understood how that could happen. But when I look at the MVA from 2010 and 2011, the same thing happens from Center City going out to like Mount Airy and those areas too. There's still this stress area in between the large economic area and the rich suburban area.
I want to thank you for allowing me to go back to the research work that actually got me to Temple. Before there was a standardized data set that was put out by the Federal Financial Institution Examination Council for HMDA data, HMDA forms were collected by banks and were available at the bank level. And one of the things I will admit to people is that I'm the only guy that I know of who went around to 50 different banks in Philadelphia and collected each one of those statements and had it key punched in two index cards, by the way, to date myself completely on this. And I created the first citywide HMDA database. Created a lot of furor. And we were invited to... And I don't want people to take biblical license with what I'm about to say. We were invited to the top of the mountain, the financial mountain in Philadelphia, the 33rd floor of the PSFS building, which is now a hotel since the bank's been put out of its misery. And we met with half a dozen banks who said, you know, the big thing is you caught us by surprise. We'd be happy to work with you if you could share your analysis with us before it's released so that we can provide context for you. Something about being brought to the top of the mountain and being shown what could be yours. Anyway, never mind. My dad was a minister, and I just, you know, I went there even though that's not what was being said, all right? It wasn't Satan. It wasn't, you know, I hadn't spent 40 years fasting in the desert or 40 days or whatever. Anyway, look, the key thing was that in looking at that particular question, one of the bankers said, well, you know that even in our supplemental lending program, which we knew there was a problem in terms of lending in inner city neighborhoods, and we've tried to set up the Philadelphia Mortgage Plan to deal with that, but you do know that once there are two houses vacant on a block, we don't issue a mortgage on that block. And I thought about what that meant in terms of Philadelphia's neighborhood context and thinking of neighborhoods as investment sites. And for whatever it's worth, that's the study that got me into Temple. And that is an insight which I forget from time to time. There are these patterns of non-interest in neighborhoods, these patterns of disinterest, are partly built on reputations that are built up over the years of these are not good investment sites. Now, I got to tell you, this same thing, there's a great story that goes along with this that's never been appropriately told. When Governor Rendell was Mayor Rendell in Philadelphia, he was hit by a group of clergy who were very interested in doing something effective in the community. And they basically said, if you give us the property that's been claimed by the Redevelopment Authority, you give us these six square blocks for $100 a block, not per property, but for $100 a block, we'll put up housing. And it won't be the same kind of housing. We will put up owner occupancy opportunities with a parking pad, no basement, just a simple concrete slab, duplex construction, mirroring the earliest suburban patterns in Philadelphia, with a place for off-street parking. They were sold out within 3 months after they finished construction. They were sold with a mortgage support. They were sold for a market price of $75,000. Their actual value was about $125,000, which is typically what they will pull down in the real estate market. It worked. It had nothing to do with a developer. It had everything to do with people that were trying to do good things that had information in front of them and knew how to amass the kind of purchasing power and organizing power of the African-American congregations in Philadelphia. It was a great example of taking Leon Sullivan's model of OIC and pushing it very hard in a different direction. We don't talk about it enough as a model, but I think that it's actually something that is of great interest as you think about futures for some of these neighborhoods. And they still don't have a supermarket. I'm afraid.
That
thank
is
you.
A 2 hour yeah. conversation.
It's more in depth.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions? I wanted to say to Dave, when I was a undergraduate student, I had a job with the then brand new Senator John Hines, an intern over the summer, and my then Penn colleague and I, Brian Sullivan, were tasked by the Senator to look into what was becoming a problem in Philadelphia, vacant housing. And having absolutely no numbers, plus being young, we tried our what we knew about going to the library and the census. We ended up engaging in what we didn't really realize was pretty decent qualitative interviewing. around, including the streets and other people in Philadelphia, about who had some knowledge about what was going on in North Philadelphia and the what was becoming an increasing problem. So I guess we all had our start somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
I had a start somewhere. Philadelphia's a great place to start. Back in that neighborhood. Yeah. I want to thank Dave Bartelt again for a great talk. I want to thank all of you for coming. I think Bob left out the dates for Jennifer Evans Crawley from Ohio State coming.
We have flyers
and Bob,
on the back.
We got flyers, and Bob's got a gift for Dave.
Can I talk to you afterward?
Yes.
So Dave, we have a
gift
monograph that we found in a bookstore here from Philadelphia 1902.
Philadelphia 1902, back when I was a youth.
Yeah, 1902. I think you're on page 37.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised.
This is great.
This is... Half the stuff in here is not going to be there anymore, but this is great. I'm an absolute fool for this kind of stuff. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody.
One other thing. We're going to explore more of these data issues at our annual users conference, June 7th. We will be sending an email out with the details as we pull it all together, but hope to see you there, too, in addition to the 12th of Jennifer.
Thank you all very much.